this is a spoiler.
You can't listen to this and not have spoilers.
Charon, The Trouble with Being Born. It is not a work of fiction. It is also, and you know, it is a philosophical work in a large sense for me, anyway. Not that boring. It's a book of aphorisms about a lot of things. But anyway, he was born in 1911 in Romania, which at the time, I guess, was Hungary, Austria. He lived the majority of his life in Paris. Surprisingly, for someone who had saw so much worth it in life, he lived to be 84. I wrote, poor sap.
Yeah.
And he wrote, after a certain point, he wrote everything in French. And people were very, very impressed with his writing in French. And he basically, and the plot, Laura, is despair, nihilism, death, suicide, human alienation. And he, the reason that I was saying joyful noise earlier is because despite everything that you might pull out of this that is so concerned with despair, et cetera, there is such an incredible, enthusiasm. Interestingly, you could never convince me that he didn't love life, despite the fact that he was very concerned with despair. Daniel actually recommended the book to me, and I started reading it, and I thought, I would like to talk about this book with the group, even though it's not fiction. And I would ask, if Daniel would want to please, that's it for me in the intro. If Daniel would want to give a little more of an intro, then I would be very happy to hear him, what he had to.
Yeah, I hadn't realized that you'd read the book before, Daniel.
Well, I just read it, and I read it maybe earlier this year, I guess, for the first time. And so shortly after, I sent a few things to you guys in emails because I just, like Mary, found it delightful. And she recommended it for the group. So I'm reading it kind of back to back, which was great because all of these ones that I'd highlighted before that were good, but then going back through maybe other ones that didn't hit me did this time. So it was a pleasant experience to return to it again. But they provoke thought. They provoke a lot of reflection. Sometimes he's frustrating. Sometimes he's insightful. Sometimes I disagree. Sometimes I'm like, wow, he really nailed it. Pessimistic, but like Mary said, it has a quality. I guess why I'm drawn to pessimistic things sometimes is that there's a certain relief, I think, when someone will say what other people have been avoiding saying, but which you feel maybe is true, or at least has an element of truth to it. And if you've been in a situation, for whatever reason, where you've had to sort of stifle that, I think it can be really refreshing to hear someone come out and say, well, this is just ruined or whatever. So he's very eloquent, and he's sometimes in diagnosing exactly what's going on. From his perspective, what's going on in certain social situations or with personal psychology or with philosophy or culture. And he's deliberately gloomy, and sometimes maybe he's at the wall and maybe they don't stick, but sometimes they do. The best way to get into it is just to read a few of them and talk about them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would just add to that that there are times when I get when I'm just really, really tired of the cult of positivity that seems to have overtaken our world. Like, you always have to see the bright side to things. It's a little bit different now that people are, you know, the utter horrors of Trump are with us, and that is the last time I will mention Trump for the entire call, I promise.
No, don't say that.
But I do think that it's interesting that we're, you know, I mean, I guess it's just part of the whole things that I would normally blame on stuff like helicopter parenting, stuff like that, how getting a trophy for losing a game, that kind of stuff, like everything has to be positive. And I think that he's a lovely tonic to let yourself enjoy as you sit back and watch in horror as they put a positive spin on every aspect of life that is just, that is actually truly horrifying.
Yeah, I think you nailed it. I mean, there's a fragility now to things and to social interaction. I think we're extremely sensitive and anxious about offending or damaging each other. And so there is an aversion to any kind of honesty that might be blended with a negative judgment or a negative sort of connotation. You know, we're afraid that we'll do damage to someone, or the unwillingness to put yourself at risk by checking someone or by expressing an opinion that won't be popular because ostensibly you don't want to hurt their feelings or you don't want to give someone a bad thought, but really,
or
I think what's going on.
That's the big problem.
Yourself. You're protecting your own feelings under the guise of protecting someone else.
Yeah, I heard this thing recently. I hope I can get this right. It's if you tell other people, if you like hide the truth from other people, you're helping yourself. And if you tell people what they need to hear or the truth, then you're helping them. And the way I take that is so often that, you know, we don't say the thing and we acquiesce to make it easier to be liked or because you want to appear a certain way. And but that's it's a selfish reason. It's like a lie of not going far enough, and it's not helping anything, like you would presume, even though that's what the person wants to hear. You're doing them a disservice,
right? And when somebody finally is able to gather up the gumption to do something, it just turns out to be incredibly rude. We don't know how to talk anymore in a way that's civil yet honest. So
this all gets into it, because I think it's a very existential thing that we're going through. And that's also like the book is incredibly sensitive. I mean, it's about, I mean, being in a very rich way. It gets in there in a way that, I mean, it reads like it. I'm surprised that it's nonfiction or labeled as such. I get it as a philosophical thing, but I mean, but it's just, it's really going for it.
Well,
the range of ideas and talking about existence and reality and consciousness in such a complex way.
I read that his mother told him that if she knew he was going to be as sad as he was when he was a kid, she said, "I would have aborted you." Sweet, honest, that's what she said to him.
Yeah. And
no, that's what I read.
No, I read that too. But that he didn't take that in a, you know, he actually saw that as something that helped him.
In what way? I mean, when I read that about him, and then I read what he wrote and other things I read about him and what he wrote, it occurred to me that if I think about if my mother had said that to me when I was 5 or 6 or 7, whatever, that if I'd known you were going to be as sad as you are, I would have aborted you. And then I turned out to have this philosophy that was more pessimistic and darker and nihilistic. It's hard for me not to see a connection there, that the person who gave life to you, and he himself, trouble with being born right there. I mean, it's hard for me not to see a connection there. I mean, I'm sure I see what you're saying, that he said that that helped him, but maybe that's because it helped him see the fragility, or not that, but the futility of existence, right?
The other thing is that he was already there. He was already there.
When he was 5?
I don't think that she said it when he was 5. I think she said it when he was a little bit older than that. And he had this aspect to his personality. You know, he said a lot of things. He did a lot of things that he later
Yeah, I know. He was like a fascist or lover or something, right, at one point?
He was, yeah, he supported a Hungarian fascism, wrote about it, but then had it deleted from the second edition of the book that he wrote about it in. And, you know, everybody makes mistakes.
Oops.
Yeah. But, you know, he didn't, he also didn't, you know, he removed it from the book, but he didn't, I don't think that he shied away from talking about it or anything like that. He's an interesting person. He's a very, you know, he's a complex person. He wasn't, you know, he wasn't perfect. I have a hard time thinking that, and maybe it's true, but that one comment, if one comment from my mother could get all that brilliance out of me, then I'll take it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm not saying that. I'm saying about, well, I'm thinking about, you know, I mean, it depends on how, I mean, you look at the brilliance, you look at the work, you look at the way he thought and the way he wrote, and then you think about him living the life that he lived. You think about, I mean, if my mother said, I mean, how could any mother say that to their child? I would have aborted you.
Mothers
and his father was
worse.
An Orthodox priest.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, so, I mean, the whole thing is just I mean, it's just freaky situation that this kid was born into.
Situations are sort of a malcontent's paradise, though, right?
Yeah, well, yeah. And, I mean, I guess so.
A malcontent who is that lyrical. That's right. The thing. Like, he wasn't he couldn't truly have been a malcontent if he dug that hard. To be that beautiful, to use language that beautiful, to say things in that beautiful a way. You know what I mean?
Like, there's many mothers that have said that to other kids. But I understand. Yeah, absolutely. He was there.
Yeah.
Yeah. His artwork is, you know, his creation is very close to the bottom, right? You know, like you're saying, I think he works with dark and difficult themes, and he creates with that material. And there's, you know, it's somewhat distasteful in a way if you come at it from a certain direction. But at the same time, I think, like you're saying, Mary, I have an admiration for for that struggle and for the majesty of being able to take that degree of darkness and difficulty and still create. Still have the inner. I mean, it's ironic because he talks so much about his ennui and his difficulty in mustering up the energy or the reason or the motivation to do anything, and yet he was so prolific.
Yeah, it is. I'm astounded that he's not more popular. I had never heard of him until Daniel wrote to us about him, and then I got the book and I decided got myself down to 2 pages a day because I loved it so much I didn't want it to end. And I will admit that I did not. Like, I skipped around as this day got closer and closer because I wanted to feel like I had gone through enough of it that I, you know, could say that I read it. But I left a bunch for myself to still discover because I really, really love it. I really enjoy starting my day by reading a few of his aphorisms and just being like, wow, like, this is amazing.
All right, well, then I want to just say this then, what I have here. And this is from, the National. And I know we want to get to some of these aphorisms before we go too far. But it says here, where is it? Maybe it was from the National or it was from, where is it? The trouble with being born is a collection of aphorisms. An aphorism is a fire without flames, he said. Cioran, is that how we're pronouncing him? Cioran?
I think it's Chiron. I don't know.
Chiron. Okay, an aphorism, fire without flames, Chiron says here. Understandable that no one tries to warm himself at it. The aphorism is, as Auden said, an aristocratic genre which fits Chiron's position perfectly. There's no more aristocratic position than to equate existence with torment. This is from The Independent, actually. So why should we be interested in the opinions of this eccentric, who is, moreover, contradictory, perverse, resistant to intellectual theory, and uninterested in questions of semiotics? Because Cioran, actually makes his philosophy perfectly democratic, assimilable by anyone, including Russell's cabbie, who can read a sentence. Cioran's loathing is genuine, all-inclusive, and yet perversely generous. the book's second to last aphorism, which I was going to bring up now, is, "No one has loved the world more than I, and yet if it had been offered to me, even as a child on a platter, I should have shrieked, 'Too late, too late.'" Which might be a joke, it says in this article. "Only someone so doubtful of the world's fundamental givens can be trusted. His skepticism lights things up like a torch." That's what it said. It's in the Independent in discussing this book. And that's interesting. The second to last one, he says, "No one has loved the world, this world, more than I." After this 100 or 200 pages of nihilistic, dark, deep, incredible of writing, but it's complicated, complex. Anyway,
it is complex, but it's also incredibly insightful. And you find it. I think that the thing that I found in so much of it is that you can call it pessimistic, but there's this longing. The suffering is from the beauty.
The beauty of suffering is from
the beauty of the world, the beauty of relationship, the beauty, these things that fall away, that disappoint us. There is this incredible potential, and I have it marked out, but I don't have it at the tip of my tongue. But if all if you look at potentiality, the incredible potential of the world and of living, and if you could have just left it all as potential, then that would have been kinder, basically, to humanity. It would have been kinder to leave it as potentiality, because as you grow and you accomplish some and jettison other potentials, you live through them and they are no longer potentials. But there is so much beauty in potential. There's so much, and there is so much potential beauty in the world. And the fact is that he wrote very beautifully. So there's there's that potentiality that was actually fulfilled, and maybe it left him feeling empty. I could imagine that it would.
Well, one of his aphorisms on page 99 is, "A book is a postponed suicide."
So do you want to start? Like, do you want to just?
Yeah,
go,
I'm sorry.
Like,
I've already done it. You guys go ahead. Yeah,
Daniel, why don't we just go in order? So Daniel, if you would start with one.
Okay, I'm looking at one and writing it down right now. He says, "A mixture of automatism and whim. Man is a robot with defects, a robot out of order. If only he remains so and is not someday put right." I like that one because he gets at something that we were talking about in our Dostoevsky discussion, which is this sort of making a sort of virtue of the irrationality of man, which is so often derided in all kinds of circles these days. I mean, I read a lot of, I shouldn't say a lot. I read some sort of cognitive science literature and behavioral economics, and it's trickled down into the popular literature now as well, the irrationality of man. And there's harm that comes from that, undoubtedly, from our failure to adhere to some kind of order and efficiency that would save us all kinds of chaos and turmoil and difficulty and just unforeseen havoc and harm. But at the same time, you can see how that's antithetical to freedom, and that it's a certain degree of irrationality may require, freedom may require a certain degree of irrationality. It may require that if every right thing can be charted out and made into some sort of efficient automated process, that we resist that in order to still have any kind of choices. And if we have no choices, what are we? What kind of lives can we have? And I don't think Ceron would be one to passionately argue for free will. In fact, I'm sure that there's dozens of aphorisms in this book that you can find that'll take the opposite approach. But I do think that he seemed to, on numerous occasions, be passionately on the other side, in the sense that he believed strongly in the necessity of feeling free. And he was despondent to have felt to look into himself and see, you know, nothing there. He was constantly searching, it seemed, for it's a paradox. I mean, he's looking for a kind of automaticity in the sense that, yeah, he wanted to escape the prison of self-consciousness, which he clearly thought was a prison. But at the same time, he wanted to see, I think, that there was something there, and that it was, you know, something, you know, worth cherishing in life. And I mean, he clearly appreciated the beauty of life. He appreciated beauty in other people. And he just didn't want to, he didn't want to make any equivocations about the stakes of life and the stakes of being concerned with life. If that makes any sense.
Yeah. Something that you said in there made me think about the kind of the tyranny of rationality, and how if you're being rational about everything, you don't leave the door open for anything out, you know, it, as if the reason that we have is complete, that we understand it, and I think that we close doors for ourselves when we think that we have figured something out using only reason.
You know? That's a better way to put it.
Well, isn't that the whole point of philosophy?
Well, some philosophies, the point was only reason.
Yeah.
So that's, you know.
I think he clearly saw philosophy as more of a prison by the end.
Yeah, I read about that, yeah.
And you can see why. I mean, I personally feel like I sort of I feel a little disenchanted with philosophy these days, I have to say. I mean, I think perhaps it's my fault for my own naivete coming to it, maybe as many people initially do, looking for truth and, you know, the way to get the answers, you know, to figure out your life. But it seems to me the more I read of it, the more I feel that it's more like art, you know, it's creating something rather than digging down to something that was objectively there.
When you say you're looking for truth, doesn't that mean you're looking for the answer?
Yeah.
And
maybe it was
I think that, yeah, I think that I never thought of philosophy as, I guess because when I went to law school, and you're taught not to really look for the answer, you're taught to look for the question.
I thought that you were taught to look for billable hours.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that does. Yeah, with some lawyers, yeah, that's what they're looking for. But really, in order to put in billable hours, you have to win the case, and really, to win the case, you have to have the you have to know the right question. But anyway, that's the way I look and still do upon philosophy. But anyway. Is it my turn?
Yeah.
Oh shoot. Okay. I'm not gonna go into a long thing like Daniel did. Yeah. That's okay. I'm cool with it. It's just I don't have as much good things to say. I mean, as brilliant. Anyway, fear. This is my one little thing. Fear is the antidote to boredom. The remedy must be stronger than the disease. And, you know, I'm sorry, go ahead. I heard. Fear is the antidote to boredom. The remedy must be stronger than the disease.
So if you're looking for a truth, there's one.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I like that one a lot.
This was the other one. Let me just say one more. I freaking love this line. I love this line. So much so, I was thinking of putting it on my email as my sign-off. I read him for the shipwrecked feeling I get from anything he writes.
Nice.
I just freaking love that line. But anyway, that's another thing I've noticed also, not just that, the content of what he says, and this goes to the lyricism and to the beauty in his writing, is that sometimes, you know, you're not quite sure what he's saying content-wise, but it's like listening to good music. It just sounds so beautifully. Sounds so beautiful. You know what I'm saying? It's not just necessarily the content. But anyway, Those are my two little aphorisms.
This second is very lyrical.
Yeah.
I totally agree with you, by the way. I think there were many times I had the same experience that I wasn't sure what he was getting at or who he was referring to. But you just get a little glimmer or a shard of a perspective.
There's something that just lights up in your brain when you read it. Or, you know, you're not sure exactly what the fuck is he saying, but it doesn't really matter. It just sounds so beautiful.
Well, I think that with the bit that I chose, it might answer a little bit of what we're talking about here. This is from page 89. It is always surprising to discover that the great mystics produced so much that they left so many treatises. Undoubtedly, their intention was to celebrate God and nothing else. This is true in part, but only in part. We do not create a body of work without attaching ourselves to it, without subjugating ourselves to it. Writing is the least ascetic of all actions. So you can't be spare in it. You actually have to put passion into it. And if there is no passion, then it doesn't. I mean, there's plenty of writing without passion, but I found that really heartening. I found that, and also that it showed me a little bit more. It showed me a little bit more of his hand, that he's, you know, this is a voluptuous activity for him.
Yeah, I that kind of, I mean, that makes me think of a couple of lines that go down that thread of the importance of writing for him. I mean, I'll save my, you know what, forget it. I'll find another favorite. One of mine was, I'm going to have to paraphrase because it's very difficult to jump around in this electronic thing. But it's, he basically says, don't write anything write what you're not able to tell your friends. Or be prepared to write what it is that, you know, is hard to say in confidence to people, the bare your soul. And he said another thing about writing for gladiators, that you should write for people as if there's like no time left, as if someone's going to be reading this and they know that they're going to die. And I think that drives a lot of his like really going for it. I mean, he's not just trying to lolly about for like chapter after chapter. Like he's going somewhere hard in each time he, you know, makes an observation. I think that's a really powerful part of this writing. You can really tell he's like invested in this in a way.
Yeah, he talks so much about his insomnia, about, you know, having spent a sleepless night, and then
3 a.m.
waking up in the morning, and you feel like there has been some tremendous quaking in his soul, and he poured out this line, and I doubt very much that he poured out this line as the line came out. I feel like he put a lot of effort into editing and into forming these beautiful lines that are, they go down so easy despite content. They're so rich.
Yeah, there's often I just had to keep going in order to get in order to read the others that I was left puzzling it out still, and others that slowly I thought were impermeable, and reading it a second time I understood, and it was a great, you know, thought. And so there's just richness. And what was amazing about this, just to kind of harp on that rather than something specific, but everything could change on a last word, or in the last phrase he could really send it home and then like leave you reeling. And that kind of like tight writing is something. This reminded me a lot of Invisible Cities. There would be moments where everything just, it's like you were following someone jogging, and then all of a sudden they sprinted at the very end. And it was just incredible. You couldn't take anything for granted. There was so much there in every word.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's right. They're very poetic. It's deceptive, because it is very philosophical, but he's committed to a coherent and, well, coherent, maybe the wrong word, but he's committed to a plain language sort of very communicable approach. He's committed to not using jargon, not obscuring, not putting things into the kind of language that's going to be so vague and abstract and suggestive that perhaps critics could trouble over it endlessly, but the common person is going to get nothing from it. He didn't like that at all, and he didn't write like that. And so you definitely, you can go over these, and some you can really sink your teeth into and stay with for a very long time, but you can also always get some impression from them very immediately.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a feeling that he was likely troubled by a lot of the philosophic reading that he did in school. I think that he remained a doctoral candidate for 10 years or, you know, longer, and wanted to make his feelings clear. And I like that. I do have to say that I like that kind of clear speech. But also, it's clear speech that you can get the, you know, you can get the surface bit, and then if you dig down deeper, as you were saying, you can, there's meat under there. There's meat on them bones.
Yeah, there's some very subtle philosophical ideas contained in here sometimes. And if you're used to reading the other kind of philosophy, very jargon riddled sort of continental philosophy, where you really have to have a long prerequisite reading list under your belt, well digested and understood, in order to come at it and get the new ideas out. He definitely was not a fan of that. And he says so explicitly in interviews I've read, but you can get it easily just through this. But it would be remiss to think then that because of that, this stuff is really just like child's play. It's shallow. It's not at all.
Yeah. Let's have your next one, Daniel.
Okay. Well, this gets back to sort of what we were talking about law and philosophy a minute ago. How about, we cannot do without the notion of progress, yet it does not deserve our attention. It is like the meaning of life. Life must have one, but is there any which does not turn out upon examination to be ludicrous?
So I'm sorry, okay. would you read that again?
Yeah, sure. I want to hear that again.
We cannot do without the notion of progress, yet it does not deserve our attention. It is like the meaning of life. Life must have one, but is there any which does not turn out upon examination to be ludicrous? So I think this is one of those that's sort of, after a reading or two, it gives me a different impression, because I think rather than just shitting on progress, I couldn't tell you, it's at 81% of my Kindle.
Oh, you're on a Kindle. All right.
Yeah. But I think it sounds at first like he's just kind of deriding progress, but maybe it's more that he's saying that progress or meaning is something that can only sort of fuel us obliquely. Then we turn our attention to it and it sort of crumbles under inspection. It crumbles underneath the scrutiny of consciousness, because, and this goes to a common theme with him, consciousness is something that just sort of disintegrates everything. But an unconscious force can motivate us. It can really propel us. I think he celebrates that in a lot of these aphorisms, the ability of drives and emotions and sort of unreflected activity and action, you know, to give mankind the motivation and the ability to live happily and in an engrossed kind of way. But he sets that up as the foil. He sets up consciousness as the foil to that. And direct attention, it seems like for him, is the thing that he can't escape from. He can't escape from this introspection, and it sort of annihilates the motivation to do anything. And he's constantly sort of lamenting his inability to stop scrutinizing his entire life and existence.
Yeah, he says a couple of interesting things about consciousness regarding fear. Like, one was something to the effect that, like, consciousness springs from fear, or and a morbid fear. He later on clarifies in another thing. He says a morbid fear rather than a natural fear. Otherwise, animals would have like the most acute sense. He's trying to make a distinction that there's a special kind of morbidity to the consciousness that's or to the fear which generates the consciousness. And he also talks about consciousness begins with something like a muted action by not going forward with something, it like internalizes and it kicks around. And he makes it seem like this kind of like, oh, and there was another one that was that like the body used consciousness to like replenish itself, or like the cries of the body would get answered by consciousness and it would spring forward kind of like a servant, not knowing what it was called for or what it was really to do. And then it would be kind of like hanging around afterwards without any real purpose. And so his view of consciousness is something, you know, kind of like, I don't know, it's hard. I mean, I don't want to oversimplify it, because I think it's something that's very crucial in this, throughout all these stories, but it's something like a
historical perspective about civilization that he takes pretty much the same approach with. So he basically thinks that the West is declining under the thrall of reason and consciousness in the same way that it's sort of bedeviled his own life. Did you guys get that sense?
I did. Mm. I got the idea that our civilization right now is kind of the personification of awake at 3 a.m. with a troubling thought.
Is this like? I mean, he was very big into political philosophy, right? I'm asking.
Don't know.
I think that he stopped writing about it after his brief romance with
the far right.
Yeah.
Ultra far right.
Yeah.
I don't know. I read something about that.
Yeah, it was interesting to hear the time frame around this. I didn't do any of that research, you know, because I wondered, you know, where the intellectual thought was at this time. You know, Nietzsche quite a bit.
Yeah, all right. I think this was written in 1972. Mm. I'm not sure. Or it was published in 1972. It was probably written for 50 years before that. There was one thing that I wanted to say about what we were talking about a little bit earlier. And I think that one of the reasons that I enjoy him so much is that I tend to like writing and ideas that are somewhat open-ended, that allow me to use my imagination to interpret them. I would rather not have a code of written laws that say exactly what this person thinks and believes. And so, interestingly, the simple way that you can take a lot of his aphorisms is the tip of the iceberg, and that you can, as Daniel was saying, is that you can dig so much deeper. And to me, I think that there have been any number of days where, 3 hours later, I go, oh, right. I feel this too.
I think that kind of goes into what Laura mentioned about Law and the Question. I heard somebody say, and I can't really get the phrase exactly right, but like the novel is the question that the book is about answering. It's not exactly the, like you're saying, Mary, the hard answer of like, this is now, ta-da, what they believe.
Right.
But rather a pursuit for something.
Ellie, no, sorry. I'm yelling at my dog again.
Don't do that. Yeah, for a second I thought that I touched on some kind of philosophical nerve.
Watch out for that newspaper across the snout, Nate.
Yeah, right.
All right, I won't talk about the boundary of artist. But you know, with something like this that is, I guess, explicitly nonfiction, we see a little bit closer the boundary. I that's just going to your point, Mary, about seeing somebody like really. I mean, he goes for it in these. And sometimes it's just lingering thought, and you're able to go one step further because he brought you to the edge or put you in the realm of this idea, and now it's up to you to like play in the space of it. That's how I felt about it. I thought it was an exploration, and I could see the exploration in the writing. Sometimes it would be, a little tell, like he would say, I just wrote the word this, and then have a thought about it. And so you could see how these were the little adventures of his own mind, and they're not wrapped up or – and some of them are self-contained. I mean, or they are like a diamond, you know, sometimes. They just can cut in a particular way. But others are a lot more notional or speculative.
Here's a good thing that goes to that a little bit. He says, a writer has not left his mark on us because we have read him a great deal, but because we have thought of him more than is warranted. I have not frequented Baudelaire or Pascal particularly, but I have not stopped thinking of their miseries, which have accompanied me everywhere as faithfully as my own.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah, I think he's companionable in the same kind of way.
I was just thinking that you take him with you. Like, mm-hmm. He takes you with him on this, you know, horrifying journey that he's having, or this very deeply felt journey that he's having, and allows you to examine those feelings of your own, but doesn't make you do anything, doesn't force you to believe.
Mm-hmm.
I really appreciated that. I appreciate it still. I mean, I really appreciate the idea that he's, you know, I know that if you sat down and talked with him about any one of these lines, if you came away with something different than he did, he wouldn't slap you on the wrist for it. He wouldn't say that you were wrong. He would probably just want to explore what had come from you. Because it's all, you know, him, I think, but he was, you know, his ideas of existentialism lets you have your own.
Okay, I want to say this. The top of this page, the first aphorism, one line is, rather in a gutter than on a pedestal.
Yes, which I wrote to Cesari this morning.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Then I go three down, and it's existence equals torment. The equation seems obvious to me, but not to one of my friends. How to convince him? I cannot lend him my sensations, yet only they would have the power to persuade him, to give him that additional dose of ill-being he has so insistently asked for all this time. And then, a few aphorisms down, one line, not yet to have digested the affront of being born.
So what do those mean to you?
This guy doesn't want to be alive.
You know, I don't know. I get that despair, like that despair from David Foster Wallace about never, you know, when no matter how much you love someone, you can never be in their skin. And there's a horror to that. There's a horror to
not being in someone's skin,
to not being able to truly understand, to never being able to know what someone else is feeling, to, you know, to never have the same experience that someone's having.
Yeah.
Here's one to understand it. Sorry.
Exactly what you're saying. I think he says, in a work of psychiatry, only the patient's remarks interest me. In a work of criticism, only the quotations.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
I have had that experience myself.
Well, I think he's saying just what you're saying. There's a certain invalidity to the commentary on experience, as opposed to the experience itself. And we're buried in commentary today.
Yeah, but
we're
also the dialogue. Isn't that part of the dialogue? The movement of the dialogue. I mean, yeah, you get criticisms of whatever, of experience, whatever, but that's not necessarily right. It's not necessarily wrong. It's just part of the dialogue, the movement.
But is it dialogue? Is it dialogue? Is it dialogue when someone writes a book of criticism about someone else's writing so long ago? I mean, that doesn't seem to me that it is actually a dialogue. It seems like two monologues.
It may be two monologues, but they're monologues to be commented on by you and by me and by Mary and by Nathan. I mean, it's not the answer. Like, that's why I guess I'm going back to that whole point of that it's all a question. Question is, like, to me, open at the end, which is what a lot of what he's doing here is, open at the end.
Yeah, I think that you're, I mean, there's I think that you're just saying, you're just agreeing with what we're saying, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, that
okay.
It's
moving. But, I thought you said like,
no,
but.
I am, absolutely. I am. But okay. At the same time, I'm just talking with Nathan about what he's saying about criticism, and that he's disparaging that there is this criticism on a writer, on a given book or whatever. And what I'm saying is that a criticism is that person's or being's, I guess, perspective, comment. It's not the quote-unquote answer. It invites, even if he or she doesn't think they're inviting, but actually they are inviting us to comment on their criticism. It's like, it's a whole move. That's why I keep thinking about it, excuse me, in terms of movement. It's not like it's a period to the sentence. You know what I'm saying?
What, yeah, how much they'd like you to think it was.
Exactly. Right. As much as they'd like me to think it is, I don't see it that way at all.
Yeah.
Well, I have a couple questions about that, though. I mean, first, I think we're assuming the priority of a sort of collective approach to this communication. But frankly, I think that there are a lot of aspects in which it's simply masturbatory. I think masturbation is actually one of the phenomena that I think extends far beyond the sphere we normally give it credit to, but it's actually a part of a lot of things that we do for self-gratification, and they exist socially under the guise of being a contribution or something like that. But what we actually do in a lot of social situations is team up together and allow each other to basically satisfy ourselves by listening to ourselves talk. And I think criticism a lot of times actually is that, especially today in the sort of institutionalized academic sort of way that people are sort of propelled to speak and to make a contribution to the existing body of knowledge on a given subject or whatever. There's a real question whether any of that is necessary, read or interesting to anyone, or really useful in any kind of way, or is it just this sort of system of production spiraled out of control? And I mean, this is one of the things I think that makes philosophy difficult to read these days, is that there's this overabundance of it, you know, this manufacture of knowledge. And it's sort of hard not to question the motivations of that sometimes and say,
it would be nice if there was some way for people to stay in academia without having to do that.
Yeah. To really only follow what was interesting to them.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree that maybe we don't need as much writing as we have. Although I have to say that yesterday, as I was reading, it did occur to me, is like, I would really like to read some of his thoughts on masturbation, like on sexuality and on masturbation, because I think that when you brought that up, I was like, yeah, right. Like it would be fitting to have something to have him have said something about it. And I thought, oh, okay.
He's silent on sex.
Sorry?
He's curiously silent on that. Yeah. Sex in general.
Yeah, probably the time. And he had, you know, manners.
Well, it's funny when you see someone who is otherwise so iconoclastic have nothing to say on such a huge domain of...
Yeah.
Well, I wonder, because when we talked about the beast in the jungle... I mean, there was this autobiographical note that came up, you know, like, you know, he was a tormented virgin or something, you know, like that. He was, you know, never had this intimacy, and you could kind of see it, you know, acutely in how he, you know, worried over sexuality and other human intimacy and things like that. And so, yeah, I thought that it was absent, you know, here too. And
well, and he didn't have it really in his life, Henry James.
But Chiron did have a life, yeah. a lifelong or lifetime, you know, life or, companion.
Yeah.
Maybe he didn't want to criticize it then.
Stay in your good graces.
I think you're right. I think it was the time.
Yeah. Yes, indeed.
Who's next? I think Mary's next again.
I have to admit that I had a few things that came up this morning and I meant to actually like sit down and pick some. I have post-it notes that like I cut up a post-it note pad and I started sticking them in the various ones that I thought that I loved. And I think I have about 100 sticking out of the book. So I'm just opening to any one of them. And I have no, you know, prepared thoughts on this. Okay. Since we remember clearly only our ordeals, it is ultimately the sick, the persecuted, the victims in every realm who will have lived to the best advantage. The others, the lucky ones, have a life, of course, but not the memory of a life.
Hmm.
Hmm.
So if you haven't suffered, you have nothing to remember.
Yeah,
that speaks to the way that suffering sort of instigates awareness and consciousness. And mm-hmm. when you're very involved and happy and really enjoying yourself, you sort of lose time.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was just thinking. And that gets back to, you know, again, this theme of how consciousness is generated, you know, in his view as some kind of like agitation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, I've had one more if you don't mind. That I just opened to that I think is hilarious. It's page 165. Beware of euphemisms. They aggravate the horror they are supposed to disguise. To use, as the French do, the disappeared instead of the deceased or the dead man seems to me preposterous, even insane.
Hmm. Could you read that one more time? I'm sorry.
Sure.
But the first I feel like is very important.
Beware of euphemisms. They aggravate the horror they are supposed to disguise. Mm. To use, as the French do, the disappeared instead of the deceased or the dead man seems to me preposterous, even insane.
Mm, yeah.
I like the one under that, too, when man forgets he's mortal.
Yeah.
See that?
Yeah.
That's a good one.
And I like the idea that he's talking about beware of veiled language. Beware of the thing that you're trying to hide in what you say so pleasantly or even so unpleasantly. But don't hide behind pretty words, which I think is interesting because there are so many pretty words in here. Not that I think he speaks euphemistically very much.
I'm wondering, is he saying that he sees that sort of as putting the sheep's clothing on the wolf through language? Like you're obscuring gravity or the truth of something or the real character of something through language, but padding is sort of like is throwing a camouflage on your own enemy on occasion or potentially.
Yeah, and also the feeling that goes along with it. I mean, you calling someone the disappeared instead of the dead is that you're adding a little bit to the mystery. He disappeared. We all know he didn't disappear. He died.
Yeah, what is that? It's maybe it's sort of like what we were talking about earlier. It's the risk aversion. It's the fear of being vulnerable in front of others, and so we pad our language, or mm-hmm. maybe to ourselves as well.
Well, it seems like there's like a twofold. I mean, if you hear that, then it has the chance to generate this kind of like world that doesn't have the reality to it. Like if you're not, you know, I'm thinking of a child hearing, you know, like disappeared. Oh, where'd they disappear to? It's like, oh, well, they gone away. They went to heaven. You know what I mean? Or those little things can abstract it. But for someone else who knows what the loss means and that there, you know, really was, you know, death or has seen it, you know, before, it can come to be a palliative maybe by not bringing it to mind, you know? And so on the one hand, you're saving yourself, but on the other hand, it's a weakening potentially.
Yeah, and maybe if you're, you know, if maybe you're only ever going to go one level down. So if I say the disappeared, you're going to think the dead man, and you're not going to go any deeper than that. And there's this kind of mysticism involved in that that doesn't go any further. But the true mystery is in the death. It's not in the disappearance. You know, it's not in the euphemism. If you don't go there, then you're never going to actually get to the mystery.
Yeah. So I've got a line. I think it's my turn, and I think it's.
I think it's always your turn, Nathan.
Yeah.
Thank you. This is philosophy in the morgue. So this is a woman, him and this woman in a morgue talking, and it's his friend that's dead, and the mother, and this is what the mother says, or not the mother, but the matron. Anyway, my nephew was obviously a failure. If he had succeeded in making something of himself, he would have had a different ending than this. You know, madam, I replied, whether one succeeds or not comes down to the same thing. You're right, she said after a few seconds thought. And this acquiescence, this unexpected acquiescence was moving. So, I mean, I think that what he's getting at there is, I think that he's stunned in the first place by that his point made it through. I think that he didn't expect to change her mind so much. And it gets down to this life and death thing that this is kind of going to possibility. And then also a lot of the things that he says that I'd like to get to, which are about before you were born, where you come from and afterwards. And this idea of, you know, like a timeless space or a potential space. I really like that line because he was surprised that he had made a connection with somebody else, or maybe, you know, he thought that they would be a little bit more hard won to accept his view, but it just cut right through everything, and even her grief.
Yeah, I like that one. Who's next? Is it me? Let me do two here I think that are kind of related. How about this? For the man who has gotten the nasty habit of unmasking appearances, event and misunderstanding are synonyms. Essential is to throw the game, to admit one is defeated. And then let's go to the next one here. To think is to undermine oneself. Action involves fewer risks, for it fills the interval between things and ourselves, where reflection dangerously widens it. So long as I give myself up to physical exercise, manual labor, I am happy, fulfilled. Once I stop, I am seized by dizziness and can think of nothing but giving up for good.
Yeah, that goes to that whole idea of being and, you know, how it's almost at an odds with consciousness. You know, that consciousness is in, what does he say at one point? It's like a post-history, or it's an after the fact. And what we, whenever like we get into the process of we're like removing ourselves with each thought and with each memory from the actual thing and actually being or doing something, like there, you know, being physical, or in other places, just having like, maybe primary motivations. You know, that's completely different than like the after the fact thinking of it and using the memories to interchange and, you know, have hypotheticals and stuff like that.
Yeah, and I think about it, I wonder, I mean, we can't really get outside of our moment in history to know what subjectivity was like at another time or in another era, or how human beings and human consciousness sort of worked itself out. And it may be that he's sort of being, well, I think he's being a little hyperbolic, as he often is about this kind of thing, but maybe it's to make a point, you know, it's in the service of something that's not said so often, because in the sort of philosophical circles where he moved, you know, the examined life is so prized, and yes, of the virtues of action and unconsciousness and the fact that still has, it's still a part of our existence. And I, you know, how different are we in this time in which we live than the way people have lived before, like I was getting to a minute ago, is it, we have so much historical baggage that we carry around with us now. You know, all of the information about the world is happening all the time. We're assaulted with it. All of our personal baggage, you know, our lives, you know, and the people that we've known and cared about, and all of that haunts us, and we have to bring it to bear on our lives going forward, even as it accumulates and we can't possibly contain it all. And yet then, you know, because of requirements and obligations and things that we have to do, we have to act, we're still responsible for bringing it to bear or not bringing it to bear on any consideration that we have to face in life. And it's sort of a tragic situation, isn't it? I mean, you know, there's no way that we can juggle it all. And at the same time, that history, it kind of gangs up on your single little particular perspective on the world. And, you know, to be aware of all of these other points out there, these other perspectives on things, and to have to try to anticipate them, it just sort of, I think he's saying that the awareness of that, it just sort of annihilates consciousness. And we're often in that position today where, because we're communicating so generally now, we have to stop and sort of censor ourselves and try to anticipate all of the ways in which our communication and our actions affect other people. And there's a sort of involved in that process, because inevitably what happens is that your own perspective on things is sort of invalidated because it can't stand up to the horde of what you're going to be communicating with inevitably.
Yeah, doesn't that go back to that quote about the future or the length of history going forward, or progress? That's what it was. And, you know, like in the face of that, you're just, you know, this little like moment, you can just be washed out looking in like the forward. You know, if you're only living for, you know, your interplay with a objective thing, then that objective thing is going to, you know, outpace you at some point. But you're still left with, you know, yourself, I think.
What am I to do after lunch? Who was that? Yeah. There is that idea though of action and then consciousness. And I always think after, you know, you go somewhere, let's say you go on vacation, I'm always struck afterward by there was this however long anticipation of going and planning, what will you do? And then you're there, and then you get back. And I always think when I get back, it could have just been a dream. Like for all that I have of it now, I might have dreamt it and retained what I retain from it, the things that I saw, the things that I did. And there is that in that, I think, you know, in pulling us away from our animal nature, from going from, you know, the action being our animal nature and contemplation being our, you know, consciousness being our human nature, it is torment. There is a, you know, that you're going to, you know, that you're going to examine it, that you're going to do something and then have to think about it afterward. And, or maybe not, but the idea that you can, that you have action and then contemplation of that action is a very, you know, and also anticipation of that action, which I think Nathan goes to the idea of your time before birth.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Because I think that this is a very interesting realm that he plays around with. And yeah, I'd like to, yeah, anyway, yeah. Okay. I'm glad that we're talking about that, because this is, yes, we've talked a little bit about how ideas are the antecedent, or I'm trying to get after the fact of the body, and then we start living in this kind of, dimension of remove each time we think about stuff, and then also there's this thing about action. I've got this one right here. Whereas any sentence one has to write requires a pretense of invention, it takes little enough attention to enter into a text, even a difficult one. To scribble a postcard comes closer to sincere creativity or creative activity than to read the phenomenology of mind. So I think what he's saying there is that even something, putting yourself out there, is this big creative move. It's the, you know, it's this really a bold gesture, even compared to something which is just taking things in, like reading would be, which, you know, is creative in its own way, but it doesn't ask of you to create. And this idea of, you know, because we have like a couple of axes, you know, like we're creating, we're feeling it, we're satisfying something, you know, that we're not even very aware of, you know, like this is the body getting the mind up to get it food. And, you know, it's all a motivation, you know, and it might all be like based out of fear, I think, is what he's trying to say, rather than a fear motivated of death. It's motivated like a birth fear. And I'm not sure I understand this birth fear.
I remember when I started looking into this, I remember how I've always said that when we give birth, we're giving death at the same time. So I think what he's looking at is that the tragedy of birth, you see, so I think he's making an assumption that which existed before birth is not a tragedy, theoretically.
I think he says something about that exactly. Like we think about the life that we could lose because we wouldn't be a part of the world any longer, but we don't think about the life that wasn't here whenever we weren't here. You know, we don't think about the world before us, but we think about the world after we're gone. And he said, now I'm remembering this, but he says that there's a difference because in the second place, having been born, you have an identity or a self to lose, which is connected to the world around you. So, and I think that he laments getting a self or an identity, or creeping into the world by, you know, crawling into existence and, you know, and thinking about that before time, like just before you were there. And that's an interesting thing that he's trying to draw a line of, like where he came into being at, you know, at what point was the first moment. And then also what's interesting he brings up is what's the first moment that something came out of nothing. Like, when did existence crawl into being, I think is, you know, paraphrasing here.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's right.
I am. There is, I don't know if it's just, you know, New Age or some, you know, offshoot of Buddhism that, you know, there is soul. There is, you know, whatever. There is being. And you have being, you are part of being, and you are, and you split away from that to be born. And in that you consciously lose on purpose, you lose your knowledge of what existed before. And you come in with a blank slate so that you can have pure experience. And then you go out, and when you go out, you rejoin the mass, you've rejoined that whatever energy or soul or whatever you want to call it. And there were times when I was reading this, when he was talking about the time before you're born, that I thought a lot about that. And I thought he's probably not thinking about this at all, but it is an interesting thing to think about. You know, if you made some sort of choice to come in and live, you know, be born of your parents and, you know, and have experiences that are pure experiences, I've often thought that if, you know, the thing that you would go for would not be the pleasant. You would, you know, if you were looking at experience, if you were looking at life, you would, and you wanted to have intense experiences, you wouldn't, you know, there's a reason why you would put yourself into a difficult situation, because you would have more of the, you know, the emotional gut-wrenching stuff is just much more intense, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. I mean, when you look back on your life, I mean, what pleasant moments, you know, are there that are really particularly meaningful to you? And it's usually, you know, your big moments of suffering or conquest or your moments of elation or joy. I mean, those are the things that seem monumental to me. It isn't the moments where, well, you know, it was 72 outside. woke up at a nice late hour. I mean, just aren't milestones.
Yeah. It's true. But the whole idea of potentiality is woven through this.
And I think Mary, I was just trying to piggyback on what you were saying, because I think that you were talking about that before, and it's, I think he used the word source at one point, and I think it applies to that idea of original potentiality and soul, and also is connected with Buddhist thought, which I think really pervades you know, a lot of this. It's interesting. I guess this was about, I don't know if this was maybe a specific time, like the 20th century, where Buddhism was starting to kind of like widen cracks in, you know, thinking, or, and I mean, I know that, you know, the Beats were, you know, really into it.
Schopenhauer, who's obvious.
I'm sorry?
Philosophical parallel to him, or predecessor of his, I think, Schopenhauer.
Yeah, I wrote that. Nietzsche. Well, was it Nietzsche, one of his?
Yeah,
well, he was a little upset with him in one thing he said, though. I'm sorry, Daniel.
Go ahead.
I agree.
What were you saying, Nathan?
That there was, he was upset with the author of Thus Spoke Zarathustra. That, I forget which aphorism it is and what his exact beef was, but it's something like he trusted that humans could go that far. It's almost like he thought that the that humanity wasn't doing a very good job of being Ubermen. Like, there weren't people like up to the game so much, or that he was, I'd like to find that aphorism, because he had a criticism of the kind of spirit being good enough to bring the change that he wanted, that it could be a revolution of everything, this this personal spirit. But I think his criticism was that the human spirit wasn't quite so grand in every day, or it didn't usually overwhelm in the way that he might have idealized that it could, that it wasn't good enough for the revolution or something. But I don't want to get, I don't want to get that wrong. I just know that he had a criticism of Nietzsche.
Well, he does here. Yeah. And go ahead, Daniel. Go ahead. No, that's all right.
No, if you have the passage, please.
What?
He talks about him.
No, I wasn't talking about a passage regarding Nietzsche. I just this little aphorism about Aristotle, Aquinas, and Hegel, which he says are three enslavers of the mind. The worst form of despotism is the system in philosophy and in everything.
There's also something he said, just if we're pulling out other thinkers that he, you know, had considerations of. Was it Plato? I want to, or maybe it was Socrates. He, the aphorism is something like, the he wonders about the wisdom of Socrates, who never wrote down anything, that maybe you ought not to write things down. Another aphorism he had was something like, what is the point of writing down exactly what you have to say? And I think calling into question, you know, just his endeavor of, you know, what's meaningful, you know, why am I doing this? And, you know, again, going back to that Gladiator quote that I really like, you know, he was talking about, so you see him play with, is it important at all? Or if it's going to be important, it needs to be very important. You need to write for someone who's going to die soon. And these words are powerful. They don't have all day. Write for, you know, write for now.
It gets back to the dilemma of consciousness and of actions being most powerful when they're sort of oblique to us, when they come at us askance, because you say, I mean, he can't, anything that seems to be a foundational sort of myth or belief or anything like that, it just sort of crumbles. And this is, I think he's recognizing, along with Nietzsche, you know, that this has happened in our society. But I think of Nietzsche, he's that, you know, so any sort of act of will or new sort of, you know, will or the primacy of it could save us, and people could accomplish being a Superman any more than they could accomplish being Christ.
I found the passage. It's on page 85. It's a little bit long, but I'll read it anyway.
Thank you.
to a student who wanted to know where I stood with regard to the author of Zarathustra. Well, he just says the author of Zarathustra.
Yeah.
I replied that I had long since stopped reading him. Why? I find him too naive. I hold his enthusiasm, his fervors against him. He demolished so many idols only to replace them with others, a false iconoclast with adolescent aspects and a certain virginity, a certain innocence inherent in his solitary's career. He observed men only from a distance. Had he come closer, he could have neither conceived nor promulgated the Superman, the preposterous, laughable, even grotesque chimera, a crochet which could occur only to a mind without time to age, to know the long, serene disgust of detachment. Marcus Aurelius is much closer to me. Not a moment's hesitation between the lyricism of frenzy and the prose of acceptance. I find more comfort, more hope even, in the weary emperor than in the thundering prophet.
This book of aphorisms, I think, is very similar to a lot of Nietzsche's work in a lot of ways. So I think there's a little hint of the anxiety of influence there, maybe.
Maybe, but maybe also just the, you know, I don't think that he never calls on anyone to be a Superman. I think that his criticism being that that Nietzsche is being naive or he was too young to not realize that he was asking for something of others that he hadn't gone through the kinds of despair. He's calls it a solitary's life. If you're not going to involve yourself with people and understand what they go through and have your own moments at 3 a.m., then don't give us all shit for it, you know, and say that, you know, rather than have our 3 a.m. moments, we should strive to be supermen.
Yeah, that was really it, the naivety of it, the not having lived a full life and having the age to consider, you know, some of these positions.
Yeah. And what do you do when you are actually faced with moments of terror or ennui or, you know what I mean? Like having not lived through those or not showing evidence of having lived through those, it's difficult to take you seriously if you're asking so much of us.
I remember that Robert Solomon course I listened to on Nietzsche, and he was claiming in that course that Nietzsche's life stacked up really well with his philosophy. And I always felt like that was a little, because Saran makes pretty much the opposite claim. He thinks that Nietzsche didn't really live the philosophy that he propounded. And that seems closer to the truth to me from what I know. You maybe can ask who could live that philosophy.
Yeah, or maybe in his madness, you know, maybe he achieved it and the result was madness. We'll never know.
Some things just work better as writing than actually being lived, don't they?
Yeah.
Well, later on he praises Nietzsche just about that. He says that if he died in ecstasy, it was a good thing. Or that he envies him because he probably died in ecstasy at that moment, which I think is referring the horse and all that. Is that right? The man whipping the horse and him jumping in love and John. Is that right? That's the story.
Well, that was when he had his breakdown, I think. I don't think that was when he died.
Oh, well, then I'm not sure what ecstasy he's referring to.
Well, maybe just maybe if madness is a kind of ecstasy, you know, if those years, I mean, I don't know, who could say. He says in an interview here that when asked why he quit reading Nietzsche, he says, it's because of that whole vision of the willpower and all that. He imposed that grandiose vision on himself because he was a pathetic invalid. His work is an unspeakable megalomania. When one reads his letters he wrote at the same time, one sees that he's pitiful, and it's very touching, like a character out of Chekhov. I was attached to him in my youth, but not later. He's a great writer, though, a great stylist.
And he obviously really did value style. He did, you know, he did value the written word.
Yeah.
Despite his...
Yeah, I think in form, he really mimics him a lot.
Yeah, I guess I haven't read enough Nietzsche to know, to have made the relation.
Yeah, me either. I wonder, you know, it's about 2 p.m. and Daniel, I know you have to go soon. So maybe we should take another look at what we got and wind things down.
Sure.
I'll read a last one.
I thought we were doing favorite lines, which is probably every line.
Yeah, I haven't read one that I did.
Favorite line.
Well, this one
maybe
just strikes
me as... Maybe if
everybody
could go around it, if they had one final one that was just like their favorite one, they could do it.
Okay. There was a time when, in order to dispel any impulse of vengeance, once I had endured some affront, I would imagine myself quite still in my grave, and I calmed down at once. We must not despise our corpse too much. It can be useful on occasion. And I thought about that because I had been offended by something from a friend, and I read it at the right time, where I had been thinking, God, why is this bothering me? Why is forgiveness difficult? Why do I feel I need to forgive? What, you know, like all of this stuff, and I just thought, oh, corpse, okay. Hey, it's okay, you know, this is a blip. This experience that I'm having right now with this person is a blip. And with my corpse, depending on what you believe, you know, if I were going to actually look back, I will remember the love rather than the slight. I will, you know, I don't need to have revenge. I don't even, you know, forgiveness is for anyone. It's for myself. Focus more on the love than the slight. So it helped.
That's a good one.
Well, I've got one, unless we have a particular order. Oh, it's always my turn. So I'll jump in.
That's right. You should start interrupting us more often.
Oh, yeah. Here it is. This one's short. In major perplexities, try to live as if history were done with, and to react like a monster riddled by serenity. I think that's, I've often thought about that, you know, how would, you know, I look, you know, read, you know, fiction or, you know, history, and you see someone in their life and you're like, why don't you just change everything? Why do you have to do all of this? Why don't you just, you know what I mean? Like, why are you doing this? And to just, you know, to think about that, but I don't think about that in my own life. And whenever I do, things start to get a perspective that is helpful. And I think this idea of, like, you know, a monster riddled with serenity, it's this kind of surety of will. I guess it's some kind of I'm taking this as some kind of like a darker version of don't think too much, just do what you think is right, you know. That there's something about proceeding forward. I mean, in major perplexities, if you're about to get lost, this is a way to move forward. And I think it's interesting. I'm not sure what, you know, good advice it is to be monstrous, but.
Well, monstrous or corpse, it's kind of the same thing, right? You get to a place where you're.
Well, I like it because it's. That's the thing about this stuff. It's not systematic. So if you're looking for contradictions, you're going to find them. And that's, you know, the answer that, you know, just don't act, just stop and think, or don't think, just go ahead and act. It's like, we all know we could get in trouble either way, and yet you still have to choose. But I mean, he brings out, you know, he makes those dilemmas lush, you know, whereas I just stated them very abstractly.
I think that there is, going from beginning to end, even of a chapter, you can find that I think that he probably had a lot of thoughts about balance, a lot of trouble with balance, with balancing love and hate and mm-hmm. despair and joy and action and contemplation, as we all do. Is, you know, one of the troubles of being born is that you get thrown into this world, into humanity, and you have to act. And if you don't contemplate, then yeah, you are a monster. I mean, isn't that kind of the definition of a sociopath?
Right. Yeah. So it's a good recipe when it prevents you from taking some action that would have been thought better of. Complains mm-hmm. also very endlessly on how it diffuses action when you might need to act. Mm. You know,
That diffusing action goes back to I think what his model of consciousness is, which is some kind of like internalized, again, agitation. And so, you know, not punching somebody and being like, nope, hold on. There's an aphorism about that specifically, I think, too, where, you know, thinking better of your first instinct. And he said something like, no is always in the blood. That I can't remember that aphorism, but maybe that rings a bell with you all.
No, K-N-O-W. No is always in the blood, or no.
N-O. So N-O. Like
negation.
Negation, yes. Right. In that there, don't be afraid to negate, because there's so much, I don't know, it's limitless. You can negate all day. So like, but or something like, no is in the blood. And then you can justify it after the fact with rationality, but it comes from a deep place that I think has to do with being and putting yourself out there. You know, this is another way that action and being are related, because actually putting out your potential or saying yes to somebody or those things have a way of encumbering you.
Yeah, and no can also be in the blood spilled, you know. Afterward, like, ooh, why did I do that?
Yeah. You know. Here's one that I think really, this one is my favorite illustration of him talking about the same thing that he talks about in a lot of these, which is ability of the imagination and its anticipation to run through so many iterations of different perspectives that you end up losing your personal perspective. And defuse action in that kind of way. He says, filming a scene, there are countless takes of the same incident. Someone watching in the street, obviously a provincial, can't get over it. I'll never go to the movies again, unquote. One might react similarly with regard to anything whose underside one has seen, whose secret one has seized. Yet by obnublation, which has something of the miraculous about it, there are gynecologists who are attracted to their patients, grave diggers who father children, incurables who lay plans, skeptics who write.
I remember that one. Yeah.
Yeah, me too. That's really beautiful.
I love it.
It was also nice to have a read that sends me to the dictionary.
Didn't we have one? What was that? Was it a Nabokov book or something? Was it Pale Fire that we all went to the dictionary?
Yeah.
Well, thanks for suggesting this one for a read. It was a nice, refreshing conversation.
Wait, yeah. I think
we have to get Laura's last.
Well, I have to say, there's two things. One, that line, I read him for the shipwrecked feeling I get from anything he writes. I just have to say that's it's up in the top 10, but there's so many lines that I think are amazing. It's hard to really, but that one really jumped out at me. But there's something I wanted to read that I read in National about him. What does Sjoren offer us? An alternative, I would argue, to the shuffling and reshuffling of pieties, to the superficial investigations of language and politics, to the long academic boredom that has settled over philosophy. To read Sjoren is to be reminded of another strain in Western culture, one that rejects the progressive ethic of political compromise and social improvement. it is customary now to refer to such eruptive and wild-hearted modes of thought, particularly where they coexist with a penetrating intellect, acute criticisms of the liberal political order, and high talent for prose, as dangerous. To demean with this label anything touched by the slightest breath of anti-modern sentiment, Shorin's work belongs to the category of the dangerous, and the word applies as both a term of opprobrium and a term of the very highest praise. After all, if philosophy is not dangerous, what purpose can it have? Oh, and I really like that. I really like that analysis of his work, and so I wanted to read that. But yeah, it's hard to find one line. The shipwreck one really jumps out at me.
Thanks. Yeah, that was a great little encapsulation there.
Yeah, really. I thought it was good.
Yes.
All right. Well.
I know it wasn't fiction, but I liked. I just want to say I liked broadening our palette here a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll say it read as if fiction. I didn't notice like a. I mean, it was just in keeping with, I think, the project, you know, of just like finding good truth and good writing.
Yeah.
And it was never boring.
Well, I was gonna
say, it was never boring. I was never bored.
Never, ever be bored by him.
Fiction a lot of the time. This one is kind of a fiction and truth, maybe, to be annoyingly pithy about it.
Or maybe, lyricism and truth, you know.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful thing.